everybody, and welcome to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're especially happy to have Robert Gallatly on the show. He is an esteemed historian of Nazi Germany and Germany in general. I suppose I should add Russia to that mix, at Florida State University. He's recently written and published a book entitled Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler, The Age of Social Catastrophe. It was issued by Alfred A. Knopf in 2007. Robert is a fantastically gifted historian and, as you'll see, eloquent person. I really enjoyed talking to him, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marshall.
Today we have Robert Gallatly on the show, and he's the author of Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler, The Age of Social Catastrophe. He teaches at Florida State University in Tallahassee, and we're extraordinarily happy to have him. Robert, thanks for giving us your time today. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure entirely.
Perhaps you could begin the interview by telling us, in our customary fashion, a little bit about yourself. That is, where you grew up, how you became interested in history, where you went to school, and so on and so forth.
Right. Well, it's almost a history in itself, but I'll cut it short. I was born and raised in the distant far north of Canada in a little town called St. John's in Newfoundland. They had a university there, I'm happy to say, and the natural pull of the university or of students graduating from the university was to go to England, and so I set off to the University of London at the London School of Economics, where I did my PhD. And I did that in the 1970s, after which I went on to Germany, where I did a postdoctoral fellowship, and then came back to the United States. I got a position in the United States at Cornell. And thereafter, my wife and I, she had a job in Canada, and I had a job in the U.S., and we had a family, and we thought this wasn't going to work, so yeah. I applied for a position back in Canada, mm-hmm. and of course, if you have a job already, it's easy to get another one, and I got one.
Yeah, great.
So I didn't think, to be honest with you, it would affect my academic career quite as much as it did. I thought I could do my research anywhere, but in fact, you really need to be in a fairly major center to be able to carry on your work. So, to make a long story short, about 10 years ago, a position I was offered, I was asked to apply for a position as a chair in Holocaust history at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know it well.
And you know, it's a great program and a great school.
Yeah.
And I was in the midst of finishing some things, and I went back to my old sort of undergraduate work where I had specialized in Russian history, and I was becoming more and more interested in Russian history.
Uh-huh.
And I was doing research in Moscow, and I got a call from the history department here where they were looking for some senior professors.
Uh-huh.
And the email I got was, would you be interested in a position which pays a lot more money and requires a lot less teaching?
I think we all wait for that call. I'm waiting for mine right now.
This is the Michael Anthony call, sort of. And in about a nanosecond, I thought, yes, I think I want to be considered for this job.
Yeah, I'm glad somebody gets that call.
Well, you know, it happened. Of course, initially you think position in, you know, as senior professor, you think, yeah, what's this about now? So I then ended up, indeed, there was a strenuous competition for the position. I was lucky enough to get it. Yeah. And now I'm at FSU, where I teach German and Russian, and also sort of comparative courses, where I'm teaching, for example, this term, courses in comparative genocide, mm-hmm. and assorted topics like that. So it's been quite a long journey.
Yeah.
I began my undergraduate career, just to go back for a second, with an emphasis on Russian history, where mm-hmm. I was particularly fascinated with the Russian intelligentsia,
mm-hmm.
these group of radical intellectuals at the end of the 19th century. And it moved forward from there, and I got involved eventually in German history, and now, after publishing a lot on German history, I've come back to, of all things, Russian history again, and so I'm sort of rediscovering the interests of my youth.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific. Who did you work with in Russian history at the University of London? Who was there?
Well, now, when I went there, they don't really have those kind of designations. Oh, they okay. have at the LSE in London, what they have is a department called International History.
Uh-huh.
And so I worked there with Professor James Joel,
uh-huh.
who was, you know, he's more involved in German and socialist and anarchist kinds of history. A very very open and friendly atmosphere there, where they more or less let you do what you want to do.
Uh-huh.
And I was particularly interested at that time in the history of anti-Semitism,
uh-huh.
with special emphasis on Imperial Germany. And basically my PhD thesis and first book dealt with the social history of a group of people who were anti-Semitic in Imperial Germany.
Yeah, why don't we talk a little bit about that? What was that first book on again?
The first book actually was called, it was meant to be a takeoff on another famous book at the time, but it was called The Politics of Economic Despair.
Uh-huh.
And it dealt with a German term, the Mittelstand,
yep.
or the middle class.
Uh-huh.
But not our American sense of middle class, but in the sense of a group between the workers and the working class and the bourgeoisie or the upper classes.
Mm-hmm.
So these people were always thought to be particularly anti-Semitic, and it was almost a cliche and a given. And I wanted to really investigate that more closely because there was no work done on the social history of Imperial Germany at mm-hmm. that time. And it turned out that it wasn't so obvious, and the cases weren't so obvious, and it had a tremendous impact. The book did on the study of these middle class individuals, shopkeeper class,
mm-hmm.
and their politics, and it fostered a lot of work in Britain and France and in Germany as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was encouraged by a late great professor at Berkeley, Gerald Zalman.
Oh yeah, I knew him. I knew him personally. Actually,
tremendous person, unbelievable enthusiasm.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And when I had finished this book and had come back to the North America, he encouraged me to. He wanted me to get involved in a project he was involved in at the time and remained involved really. For the rest of his life, namely the German inflation.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to take the period from the First World War where I'd focused and focus on what happened to the same groups of people during the Great Inflation,
mm-hmm.
the greatest inflation probably in world history,
yeah.
in 1923 in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And to be very honest with you, I thought I really didn't want to be pigeonholed as a historian of the shopkeepers. I had enough shopkeepers.
Yeah.
It's not that I have disdain for some. I mean, many shopkeepers are great friends of mine, but I did not want to do this, so I had to resist it. And
it's funny you mentioned that because you know one of the things I've talked about with other historians is. Doing this podcast is the frustration that some of us feel in being, as you put it, pigeonholed. And this happened in my own career. I mean, I had written several books on early modern Russia, and I felt I knew everything I wanted to know about early modern Russia. Yet the expectation was that I was still to write other books about early modern Russia.
Right.
And I didn't want to do that anymore. Yeah.
It's very difficult to get out of the pigeonhole that
really
people
is.
Put you in.
It really
you
is.
You know,
yeah.
Even now when my books are reviewed and so on, you know, they invariably rehearse the fact that he is a German historian.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It doesn't matter if I've learned Russian and I've gone into
yeah,
Russian
right.
History
material,
and
yeah.
this, I am forever pigeonholed.
Oh, don't I know
and
it.
Should a job come up,
yeah.
I have to, in my job talk, I would have to make a case for, actually, I'm a comparativist.
Yeah.
That would be the best I could hope for.
It's really tough.
So when I came here, that's what I did.
Yeah.
You know, basically say, I've now moved into comparative history, and
yeah.
people can buy that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what you ought to do, to sort of sell yourself as a comparativist.
But it's very strange in the sense that my wife is a mathematician. I think I've mentioned this on other podcasts, but I, you know, have occasion to talk to mathematicians, and I tell them that most historians work on the same topic, or at least the same sort of period place, their whole lives, and they can hardly believe it. No mathematician would ever do that.
Yes.
Nobody
yes.
would ever. They think we're crazy, and I think we're crazy too.
Well, I think, of course, now what happened to me then is that I started to, once I got through this and I was into my teaching, I was looking for another topic, and I was doing archival research, and I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do, which was essentially what I wanted to do was to do a history of anti-Semitism. The history of anti-Semitism going from Imperial Germany, let's say from 1914 all the way through to 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, look, this is a topic which at that time, it seemed to me, was under-researched and really needed a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I really knew this topic and it would be very easy for me to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I set off to Germany to sort of just fill in some places that I felt, you know, I needed to brush up or to get some primary sources and so on. And so I started in the north of Germany and I worked down until I got to Munich. And when I was in Munich, I was working away and everything was settled completely. And I was quite happy. And it was a day before I was going to go home. And the archivists, who are usually incredibly unfriendly and uncooperative.
Uh-huh.
There was one who was cooperative, and he said, Herr Geletli, before you go home, you know, we are currently an index for special files that are very rare. And we have them in house now. These are 19,000 files
uh-huh.
of the Geheime Staatspolizei, the dreaded Gestapo,
yeah.
Or secret state police. And these people, these files, he said, rather, are extremely rare. They exist almost nowhere in Germany. They've all been destroyed. And so maybe you'd like to have a look at these because there's
goodness.
A lot about anti-Semitism in them.
Yeah.
So I come into this room and it's packed to the ceiling with these old files, and I look through these files, and they're all personal files, just like your present everyday ordinary file folder,
mm-hmm.
and they're by person, that is to say, by the person, by, you know, Smith, John,
yeah.
Ruth, Jones, Ruth, and so on. So it's impossible to sort of make head nor tail of what they are really all about, and so I start going through them. Some of them are like one page. Some of them are 500 pages of loose leaf all scattered all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out what is this. And what it were the files that the police created whenever anybody was suspected or accused or brought in for arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started a file immediately, and they kept track of these various cases. Some people had 10 offenses, or some people had just one page. You know, someone phoned in about them or something, like a marital dispute
mm-hmm.
or whatever. So I thought I didn't really know quite what to do with those. And I thought they were very important, but they'd never been studied before. No one had really ever seen them before. And so I came back the following year when these files were back in this little tiny town in the middle of Germany called Würzburg,
mm-hmm.
which is just approximately 100 miles or so east and south of Frankfurt,
mm-hmm.
and I went into the archive and I started going through these files, and what developed, in fact, was quite interesting, because in the archive, you know, it's just a one big table with all the users in there, the various users of the archive. These would be mostly people interested in their family history, or, you know, looking at, you know, what happened to our house or some property issue or something like that. And I'm sitting there in the midst of this with these big stack of files with all these, you know, they're all stamped, you know, top secret and so on them.
Mm-hmm.
And people are coming up and wondering, what is this person doing? So finally, an elderly gentleman came up to me and we went outside, and he said, you'd probably like to interview me because I used to live here at that time.
Oh, really?
And I said, well, you know, actually, I can say this to you. At that time, at least, I didn't think very much of oral history.
Uh-huh.
And I was a little unsure about the what I should do. So I said, well, look, let's just have a coffee and let me just ask you some questions.
Uh-huh.
Because as I read through the file, as you read through these files, you start to make a mental picture of how the police could get so much information. I mean, where did it come from? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they must have had, the first thing you think of, there must have been police everywhere. And I have no idea. I mean, I had an amateur or a beginning, a very rudimentary understanding of what the police system was all about and mm-hmm. the SS and all that sort of thing. So I said to him, look, you know, what about this and this and this? I asked all these questions, and then I finally said, by the way, were there a lot of Gestapo here during the war years? I mean, you lived here. He said, oh, they were everywhere. They were everywhere.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, of course, you know, I said to myself, well, once I go back to the U.S. And give this paper based on these files, people, the first thing they're going to ask me is, well, how many is a lot? You know, how many is a lot of policemen, and how many exactly are there? So I had to nail down exactly how many there were, and I went back and asked the archivists, and of course, typically they said, that's one of the dumbest questions we've been ever asked. And on it went. It turned out to be quite difficult to ascertain just exactly how many there were.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, after many archive trips in many other archives, I eventually figured out a method of discovering how many police were in every single German city, in
mm-hmm.
fact. And so I can tell you every single city, and the dates, and precisely how many members of the police were there.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I found the key was how the secret police got their automobiles.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Contrary to popular belief, not every member of the secret police in Germany had their own Mercedes.
Yeah,
you know, you got them according to the population, according to a figure called the number of enemies or suspected enemies,
uh-huh.
The length of the border that may or may not have passed through your region,
uh-huh.
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I could determine exactly, and you know, more or less the number of Gestapo per capita.
That is just remarkably clever, let me just say.
Unbelievable.
That.
Yeah, well, what was really amazing is that we have an area which is a fairly large area, larger than, say, the average, if there's such a thing as the average American county, say, three or four counties. This would be Lower Franconia in Germany,
mm-hmm.
but three or four counties with over a million population, with one city of 100,000, an area that was Catholic and therefore more or less anti-Nazi.
Yeah.
And to cover all of this, they had a grand total of 20 police officers.
So I
thought to myself, okay, 10 of these 20, actually more than that, but 10 of these 20 were involved in what the Germans call desk work.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 were actually involved in police work. So to police all of that area with 10 individuals.
Yeah.
Now, these 10 individuals put together what survived a grand total of 19,000 files. So I thought, how in hell could this few people, so few, possibly put this together?
Yeah.
And the answer, I began to see the answer was, whoa, it is not the proverbial police state. It is, in fact, the reason that they can do this is that friends and neighbors, ordinary Germans, are coming forward volunteering information to the police.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because I had a similar sort of revelation that I did not follow up on, I have to say. I'm sure there's somebody following up on it. I was teaching a class a number of years ago on Stalin and Stalinism, and we were reviewing statistics about the number of people that were killed by the NKVD. And I'd also studied the Holocaust, obviously, and the Holocaust is extraordinarily well researched, and we know a lot about how the actual killings were prosecuted. We don't know much about it in the Soviet case, or we haven't until recently. And so I remember just doing a small statistical exercise with my students, comparing the number of people that we knew were in the NKVD at the time and in the place with the number of people that were reported to have been killed.
Right.
And the numbers just didn't add up at all. There was simply no way that number of people could have killed all, you know, the mass that they were supposedly to have killed. So
right.
Something else was going on. You know, it just wasn't logistically possible. Yeah, because I mean, I knew from the German case, the Germans had more or less tested this in the field. You know, how many people does it take to kill how many people? And it was clear that these numbers were far in excess of anything the NKVD could have done.
Well, now you see, the thing is, in my new book, which we'll talk about in a second, but the Lenin, Stalin, Hitler book, what I show there in the Soviet Union, and in fact reinforces your point, in that the way the Soviets proceeded, as opposed to the way the Nazis proceeded by having the neighbors and friends and so forth talk to the police and come inform, send anonymous letters, telephone, every which way. But they wanted this popular participation in the policing system.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Soviets operated, they didn't have enough secret police to do the work that you suggest they were doing. That's quite right. And so they proceeded by way of setting quotas.
Yeah, that's right.
So they set quotas, and people, the police, fulfilled these quotas in the most absurd way thinkable.
Yeah, that's right.
For example, going to an ordinary fire, a building on fire, and cordoning off all the people surrounding it, and then charging them with subversion.
Yeah.
Or in the case of, for example, when they were in this Polish campaign, anti-Polish campaign at one stage in the 1930s, they in desperation to try to fulfill their quota, the policemen just went down through telephone books looking for Polish-sounding names.
Yeah, no.
And tracked them down, just got them that way.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely, but it's quite a contrast.
Yeah, it is quite a contrast. You're right. No, that's true. No, go ahead.
But see, this brings out the contrast that I make in the new the Lenin, Stalin, Hitler book, which is that, and this is of course controversial. It's going to be controversial. That Nazi Germany was essentially a consensus dictatorship, and that is to say, it basically built on, and required, and they sought to be an authoritarian dictatorship, but also popular. Whereas in the Soviet Union, Stalin and Lenin before him, and then Stalin, were not interested in consensus. They were not interested in public opinion. Uh-huh. They were the avant-garde.
Yeah.
They knew what was best.
Yeah.
And so they would basically set quotas and all the rest of it. They didn't give a hoot for public opinion. Theirs was an avant-garde dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the major contrast I bring out in my book, as opposed to all the other books that compare the two regimes, the Nazi and Stalin systems.
Let's talk a little bit about the historiographical context, since you mentioned it. What had been thought by professional historians about the relationship between, you know, sort of popular participation and support and the Nazi regime prior to your own work?
Well, it's amazing, actually. I mean, most people put the emphasis on the power of the state. They sort of implied, but never really asked the simple question: how was policy enforced? They took it for granted that it was done some way. It wasn't really pursued, and the result was there was a lot of mysticism or a lot of, you know, sort of hypotheses or guesses about it, but no one really pursued it. It seems like any really, really good answer in history to an important question, it seems really obvious after you found the answer. It seems so, well, why didn't I think of that? And the answer is, well, what kind of cooperation did the police in Nazi Germany get from the population? That seems like an obvious question. We know in the United States that it's impossible for a police to work without the cooperation of citizenry.
Mm-hmm.
We know, to make a dramatic contrast, we know that in Iraq, the difficulty with the United States is running into there on the ground is that they cannot get the cooperation of ordinary Iraqis, because of course they're threatened and all the rest of it, but that's neither here nor there. The fact is, it's very difficult to get that cooperation. And there'll never be enough Americans to do this unless and until they can get that cooperation. Now, what I did was take this, I mean, I just sort of discovered this, and there was this the sort of feeling of that, oh, you're trivializing the importance of the Gestapo.
Mm-hmm.
That was the charge that was leveled against me by some historians. And I thought, you know, this is complete nonsense. What, in fact, I am saying is, of course, the Gestapo was perfectly horrible and committed all kinds of abuses. But the buck doesn't, you know, we cannot use the Gestapo as an alibi for a nation. I mean, it's far more involved than that. It is the whole, this is nice for us. It's comforting for us to think, well, they had the Gestapo, and they, all these horrible things happened, whereas in our society, we don't have those horrible people. We don't have Hitler. We don't have the Gestapo, so those things could never happen here.
Yeah.
In fact, of course, it is precisely this popular participation which is the key ingredient to that system. And it got that popular participation. You know, of course, people don't like to hear this, but I'm afraid it's true. They got the cooperation of the population to the bitter end in 1945.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, no.
They did. I mean, and the famous picture that you know, Marshall, of the Soviet soldier planting the red flag in Berlin on the top of the parliament building, the Reichstag building, the famous picture. What we always forget is at that time, there were German soldiers in the basement of the building that fought on against Soviet troops for days afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you cannot order that.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, I know.
You can't order that.
I'm always quite interested
to tell people and see their reactions when I say, and this may be somewhat inaccurate because I'm not an expert on the period, but that the Nazis, when they had their greatest electoral success, ran on an anti-democratic platform.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they explicitly said that they were going to, if not close down the Reichstag, they were going to severely limit popular participation by other political groups. This is usually unthinkable to people. I mean, they don't understand this. And that they received a lot of votes on the basis of this platform. Because people were a little bit tired of democracy. They had had enough of it. And this is something that, to an American mind, and I won't speak to the British or whomever, but is completely foreign. We cannot understand how anyone can be tired of democracy. But they were, and the Nazis basically were giving them what they wanted.
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, in that little town where I was working on the Gestapo, one of the newspapers, I read newspapers and all the rest of it as well, from that period, and one of the newspaper headlines from 1932, and this is a Catholic area, they never voted socialist, much less for the Nazis. This is a non-Nazi area. And one headline in 1932 ran, and I'm quoting, "It could just be that what we need is an experiment in dictatorship."
Yeah, no, exactly. No,
and you know, like they got fed up with the economic troubles, all the endless elections, and so, you know, I've been used now for the last several years of talking about how the regime took root in German society so quickly. You know, it happened overnight. It was the exact sort of converse of the Russian Revolution, which was violent and led to civil war and so on, whereas Germany, there was this peculiar phenomenon called a legal revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's a contradiction in terms, because a revolution by definition is supposed to be illegal.
Uh-huh.
But here you have a legal revolution, and the transition is very, very smooth.
Uh-huh.
Now, All the British reviewers, in particular of my book, most recent book, the Lenin, Stalin, Hitler book, what they say is, he forgets the fact, he downplays the fact that the Nazis in a free election never won a majority.
Uh-huh.
Now, there is an election which Hitler calls for after he's appointed chancellor on the 30th of January, 1933.
Mm-hmm.
One of his only real demands, is that there be a new election called, mm-hmm. and this is called for March.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that the Nazi Party does not win a majority.
Mm-hmm.
I should add that there are 13 parties, and no party in the entire history of the Republic ever won a majority.
Ever won a majority, yeah, that's right.
And however, they've been the largest number of votes of all time, and they are a coalition. That is to say, they are running with another party called the Nationalists, and between the two of them, they do indeed have a majority.
Mm-hmm.
They do have a majority.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that, you know, if you look at the autobiographies or the a particular one, which was a real big hit just recently. You know, this person was, the book is called Defying Hitler, which is a very bad translation of what the book is really about. But in this book, this man, Sebastian Hafner is his name, what he says is very instructive, and he was strongly anti-Nazi, and he has, his girlfriend was Jewish, and indeed they left Germany in 1938. What he says is this, what people forget about this transition from the Republic, the Democratic Republic, to the dictatorship was that if there had been an election 2 or 3 weeks later, then indeed Hitler would have won a clear majority and handily. And so, you know, this notion that this was somehow a kind of fluke that Hitler got in, and that they used terror to keep in power. They used terror, and it's lots of terror, but they use, how can I, you know, the question comes up all the time. Look, how can you talk about this being a consensus dictatorship when there's all this terror? And I say, yes, there is terror, but the terror is used against people who are already unpopular or thought to be threatening, such as, you know, such as recidivist criminals, communists, and so on. And getting those people off the streets, as would happen in the United States, it has to be said, just to be, you know, make it clear, we have the three-strike rule, and that's, those are the kinds of things that they instituted in Germany, and these were enormously popular. So they create concentration camps. The people that put in them, for the most part, initially, are social people who are social outsiders, people who are alcoholics, welfare cheats, or people who are deemed to be welfare cheats, I guess I should say, people who repeat offenders, and those kind of individuals. And so, so you have a situation where the streets are cleaned up. There are no longer the beggars in the streets. They're now being forced to work in concentration camps. And frankly, this is what makes this authoritarian dictatorship also popular.
No, I think that's exactly right. It's funny you mentioned Sebastian Hafner, because a long time ago, actually, and I wasn't, I don't know how I came to read this book, but it's called The Meaning of Hitler.
Yes.
Do you know this book?
Yes, I do.
I very much admired it. It's extraordinarily short. And Hafner is a journalist, by the way, not a historian.
Yes.
But I read the book, and, you know, it was as if the scales were lifted from my eyes, because every word of it was just, you know, that's right. He's right about that. Another book I'd like to plug that relates to something you said was, and I'll try to get this right, it's a kind of revisionist history by a fellow named Mark Mazower, or Mazower, called Dark Continent. Do you know this book?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, and basically it is consonant with what you're saying about, you know, a kind of desire for more order and a failure of democracy in the 1930s in Europe. It's
right.
A time in which we'd really forgotten. And he has some wonderful examples of, and one of them I recall that, I don't know if it's true or not, I should probably not restate it, but apparently Churchill in the 30s went to Italy to speak. And he told the Italians that, you know, democracy was only for some people, and it definitely wasn't for them. And so,
well, yes, of course. And he was famous for saying that Mussolini got the trains running on time.
Yeah, right, exactly. I didn't know that he had said that. But, yeah,
yes.
I'm always really shocked by this. You know, democracy is for us, not for you. So you go ahead with this dictatorship thing. But, you know, I see exactly what you mean. Let me ask a little bit more controversial question and relate it back to the subject of anti-Semitism, because, you know, there is this large debate in Holocaust studies between the kind of Christopher Browning school and the Daniel Goldhagen school, Browning saying that, you know, many ordinary Germans were sort of in a situation in which they had to act in a certain very unsavory way, and Goldhagen saying that they were predisposed by whether anti-Semitism or whatever it happened to be to act in this way. How does your own work relate to these questions?
Well, I'm happy to say, though I don't think the truth is always in the middle, I'm somewhat between both schools. What I think Daniel Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, is a very important book. It was a huge popular success when it came out about 5 or 6 years ago. It was deeply resented by a lot of historians, to be very frank about it, because they don't. There's a lot of professional envy, and also because that isn't the only reason. But what Daniel said, and in his book, which I still recommend people should read and know at least, what he says is that killing the Jews was a German national project, and that Hitler's role was merely to release the brakes.
Yeah, he was a catalyst.
That's all he did. I mean, so basically the Germans wanted to kill all the Jews, and Hitler basically provided the situation in which this would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that is actually the case. I think there was a lot of latent anti-Semitism in Germany prior to 1933 when Hitler gets into power. I think the Nazis were much more anti-Semitic than most historians writing the big popular successes like Ian Kershaw or mm-hmm. Richard Evans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that anti-Semitism was much more important to the Nazis than they will concede.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting story why they continually downplay the importance of anti-Semitism as a factor in attracting votes to Hitler, but
mm-hmm.
they do.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I think once, that is to say then, in summary, that anti-Semitism is not the only reason that Hitler gets into power, but that no one can vote for the Nazis without realizing that this is the most anti-Semitic political party in German history.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean that Hitler in 1933, much less in 32, 31, and so on, actually visualized the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
but that he certainly did want to do something about the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
He perhaps visualized driving them out.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly talked about that. He wanted the United States to take them, Canada to take them, anyone
mm-hmm.
to drive them anywhere, to send them to some place, somewhere. Now, what happens in 1933 onward? And here I think Hitler's role is much more important than Daniel Goldhagen will perhaps agree, that Hitler and Nazis, the Nazi Party and government, gradually make anti-Semitism more and more popular. Anti-Semitism spreads.
Mm-hmm.
The government is openly anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism comes to inform many government policies. It becomes impossible to overlook. And I think at a certain point in 1938 or 39, a lot of people agree now there indeed is a Jewish question,
mm-hmm.
and wouldn't it be better really if the Jews somehow just went away?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they still want the Holocaust or what comes to be the Holocaust, but they believe now that there is an issue, and wouldn't it be better if it was solved in some peaceful way, perhaps by the Jews emigrating to Palestine or Canada or somewhere. Now, when the war starts, the war revolutionizes the revolution, and it becomes infinitely more brutal, but especially towards foreigners. There is a crackdown inside Germany, but the real terror is against non-German people.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people in the burgeoning concentration camp system, the vast majority are non-Germans.
Mm-hmm.
So the consensus dictatorship and the general agreement, in my opinion, holds. And so you have these foreigners in those camps, and especially, of course, the Jews. Now, I think this acceleration into mass murder begins slowly with the opening of the war in September 39, and it takes off especially after June 1941 with the attack on the Soviet Union. Especially, I am in agreement with Christopher Browning and others who now tend to believe that Hitler made a decision on or during October 1941 for the mass murder of the Jews. The reason for the controversy about the decision is we have no smoking gun.
Right.
We do not have a document.
No Führer's Befehl, as they say.
That, of course, leaves the door open for the deniers, by the way, says, oh, well, it never happened. There's no such thing.
We should also just pause for a second to plug a book by Browning, the name of which sort of escapes me, but it is a very detailed, long study about...
Are you talking about his the Final Solution? It's The Evolution of the Final Solution.
It's something I can't remember the name of the book. I'm sorry to say, but I just read it.
It's called The Origins of the Final Solution.
Yeah.
And it's this great, huge, thick book, but it only it deals primarily with the decision making process.
Yes, that's right.
From 1939 to about 1942.
Right. It's not about the implementation of the Final Solution itself.
No,
it's
not.
That's very well elsewhere. But
Christopher Browning did, of course, that famous book, Ordinary Men.
Ordinary Men. Yeah. But
yeah,
I read the book very very carefully, and I thought it was really terrific. It was the most detailed analysis of the policy decisions that I had read. And then I also read, kind of in conjunction with it, another book that I would recommend called by a fellow named what is his name? David Cesarani, or it's called Becoming Icon?
Cesarani, yes, David Cesarani.
Do you know this book?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I read
It's very good too.
Yep.
There's a number of very good books come out now on the Holocaust. But just to go back to the Browning, where I differ with Chris slightly, he's a very good friend, and I'm immensely respectful of his work. He's just a tremendous person, I would add, and as an individual. And the same is true. I'm not trying to say anything. The same is true of Daniel Goldhagen.
Yeah, I know. Actually, I know Daniel a little bit. I used to teach with him at Harvard. So
he's a very likable, wonderful person. He's very committed, and you know, I admire him, and I think he's been basically. Well, how shall I put it? He was harsh to in his criticisms of others' work, and they turned, sort of the profession has turned its guns on him.
Yeah, no.
And I think to some extent he's been, although I hate to use the word, but sort of ostracized from the scholarly profession.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. I don't think you should be any hesitant to use that word, because he has been.
Yes, he is. but no. What happened with Chris is that, of course, he was involved more directly with Daniel Goldhagen than I was, but what happened is that they happened to be dealing with similar archival files in Ludwigsburg.
Right.
These are files kept by the court system that investigated these crimes long after they were over in 1945. Mm-hmm. And what happened is that Christopher's book came out first, and it's probably a better book called Ordinary Men.
It's certainly shorter.
Yeah, it is. Now, what Christopher does, Chris Browning does in this book, is that he suggests that in the end, the factors that seem to have motivated these men had rather less to do with ideology, and particularly less to do with anti-Semitism, and more to do with circumstantial conditions, peer pressure, and other psychological factors. And in my opinion, I think there's a slight danger of underestimating the importance of anti-Semitism in their motivations.
Yeah.
Now, why is it that such a misunderstanding, shall I say, should come about? And what we have to remember is that they were working from court documents, and these documents are put together by prosecutors who are unbelievably gifted and thorough. And so when they're questioning these men, approximately 200 plus men who were involved in one of the police battalions who did the direct killing of Jews one at a time, by the way, shooting them, as you know, one at a time. What these prosecutors would get from these individuals was every possible excuse you can imagine. I was drunk. It was my peers. It was my fellows. I didn't want to appear out of line, et cetera, et cetera. But what they will not admit is that their actions were motivated by malice or hatred.
Mm-hmm.
So they're never going to admit to a prosecutor, yes, I killed these people. I hated them. I killed them, and I'm glad I did it. Because that turns this then into a clear case of capital murder.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get ordinary people admitting that to a prosecutor who's about to take them to trial.
Yes.
And so the last word that will come from their mouths is, I did this because I was anti-Semitic.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're exactly right about that. Well, I mean, the controversy kind of continues today. I notice it sort of even makes its way into, I had also read Ian Kershaw's two-volume biography of Hitler, and especially in the second volume that actually deals, I think it's the second volume, that deals with the coming of the Holocaust. He has a concept which I really quite liked, called working, I believe he says it's called working toward the Führer. Do you remember this? In other words, what he says is the Führer didn't need to tell people that he wanted, you know, Jews locked up or Jews exterminated or things like this, but he created an atmosphere, a set of incentives in which that sort of action would be rewarded. So people worked toward him in that way. And I think it's a subtle concept, and I think it's one that actually people can recognize in their own lives as, for example, they try to please their bosses. You know, their bosses actually have to tell them what to do.
Well, where I would differ slightly with Ian Kershaw, and of course I've had my own little disputes with all these people, including Ian.
That's what makes it fun.
It is. But where I disagree slightly with him is this, that I think Hitler made known his ideological precepts far more, far more clearly, and he espoused these. I mean, it wasn't just any old thing. I think this will please Hitler. I mean, Hitler made clear what would please him. He said it over and over again.
Yeah.
He said, for example, on January the 30th, 1939, he is. This is the first major speech he gives. After the so-called pogrom of November 1938, the so-called Reichskristallnacht. And in there he starts this, let me issue a promise. You know, people have often called me a prophet, and let me be a prophet, he says, one more time. Should the Jews succeed again, namely, of course, accusing them for causing the First World War, should they again lead us into a Second World War? Then this time the Jews will pay, not just the people of Europe. And it's this promise which he says over and over again. And, of course, at some stages during the war, indeed, Goebbels is saying, you know that prophecy he's saying? I'm sorry, Goebbels is the propaganda minister, and he's saying this in newspapers. Hi, folks. Are you reading my lips? You know the prophecy thing?
I'm laughing, but I shouldn't be laughing.
Do you know the prophecy thing? Well, it's happening. Now, I don't know what your average individual is supposed to conclude from this. And, of course, Ian Kershaw is a perfect example of someone. This prophecy was put on a propaganda poster and was actually stylized, you know, in that Gothic stylized sort of print, and put on the... on street corners all over Germany in September 1941, namely exactly at the moment when Jews were starting to be deported out of Germany.
Right.
So, my notion is that there's that the linkage between Hitler is not just sort of this kind of vague structural linkage between Hitler has some ideas, I think, and so forth. He's giving quite specific instructions, and of course, Hitler is adored. He's regarded as the greatest statesman in German, indeed in world history.
I know.
At that time.
So let's turn now to the Soviet side of the equation, one about which I know a lot more. And let me just set this up a little bit for our listeners who may know some of this. When I was in graduate school, there was a kind of trope, a figure, that was good Lenin, bad Stalin. And you mentioned this a little bit in your book, under which Lenin was a sort of mild social democrat interested in the welfare of everyone. And Stalin was a very bloodthirsty bad man. What is your take on this?
Well, that was very interesting. See, I started off writing a book in which I was going to compare, as everybody does, Stalin and Hitler. Of course, I started off like everybody else does as well by saying that it should be actually. I started off by saying the comparison was Hitler and Stalin, and I realized that most of these books, like Alan Bullock and other books like that, most of these books, in fact, take Hitler as the norm and compare. You know, like okay, Hitler did A, B, and C. What are the equivalents that Stalin did? So Hitler did A, B, and C, and Stalin did the kulaks or whatever. You see. So what I did then was to investigate slowly but surely the figure Stalin, and I said, oh well, first of all, we have to put it in the proper order. After all, Stalin was in power long before Hitler was. Before Hitler's putsch, really, Stalin was already a major figure, the Hitler putsch of 1923. Much less, you know, Stalin was a powerful figure already before Hitler was released from prison in late 1924. So once I started focusing on Stalin, I realized the more I read, and of course, I had the same exact paradigms as you did in my head, namely that Stalin was the bad guy, Lenin was the devoted revolutionary, the good guy, or at least there was this good Stalin, good Lenin, that and Stalin messed up all the things that he did.
Right.
Now, the more I read, and of course there are new books coming out about, particularly from the secret archives that were not revealed for so many years, as you know, particularly since the 1990s, a lot of this new material came out, and the more I read, the more I began to see that indeed Lenin was not the good Lenin at all, but Lenin was the man who was the bloodthirsty driver of the revolution, a man who prior to 1914 already was saying what we need is not just a revolution, we need a civil war.
Yeah.
And that he said, you know, we can't introduce socialism like a cheap piece of bourgeois legislation.
Right.
This not that kind of thing. It has. It requires violence and civil war.
Yeah.
This guy was bloodthirsty in his ideas, in his plans, and then, of course, he was the one who urged on the revolution at every turn. And what I have, what I show in my new book, which, the Lenin, Stalin, Hitler book, what I show is that you cannot understand Stalin without focusing on Lenin, and that basically, I would say, Stalin did nothing innovative, create anything really new that Lenin had not already introduced, whether that is purges, whether it is the secret police and concentration camps, and therefore it's impossible, really, to, in my humble opinion, to study Stalin in isolation from Lenin, because from 1917 on, Lenin is the man who is in charge of the avant-garde dictatorship. He says, look, if we leave the workers to their own devices, as you know, they're just going to want lower wages, you know, the usual trade union nonsense. So we're going to be an avant-garde party. We're going to be in the forefront of the revolutionary struggle. And by God, when we get into power, we're going to create an avant-garde dictatorship. And he starts calling it a dictatorship, a revolutionary dictatorship, a provisional. First it's provisional revolutionary dictatorship. He calls it that prior to 1914. And already prior to 1914, before the First World War, he's already dropping the word provisional. And so eventually it becomes, of course, as some of one of his guys, and namely Leon Trotsky, said, this will eventually be not the dictatorship of the proletariat, but more like the dictatorship of the Communist Party, and in fact, really, the dictatorship of Lenin. And that's exactly what it turned out to be.
No, I think that's right.
There's an extraordinarily interesting historiographical moment here, and I know it quite well because I sort of lived through it. And that is, you know, my teachers actually in graduate school, some of them at least, and actually, and my cohort as well, were involved in the kind of dissection and even, I would say, to some extent, production of this notion of the good Lenin and the bad Stalin. It's a very interesting story about how it came about, and then, you know, how it actually was eclipsed and by whom.
Yes. Who was your teacher? We'll track him down.
Well, no, he was a great man and certainly a fantastic advisor. It was Reginald Zelnick, was one of the people that was very interested in developing a kind of new historiography, social history of the revolution, trying to understand it. And the basic thesis, I think, not to be too crude, of much of this work was that the revolution had a lot of popular support. And that may or may not be true, but it's not really relevant to the question which follows, which they didn't address, and that is what happened after the Bolsheviks got into power and started things that they called themselves like Red Terror. I mean, do you really need to be an epistemologist or a great historian to understand what is meant by Red Terror? And, you know, they sort of ignored this part of it. And you know, I think for a lot of us, for many of us, there was a kind of cognitive dissonance because we would read the documents and then we would hear about the good Lenin, but these two things didn't go together. And the person that kind of opened my eyes to it was Richard Pipes, who knew this from the beginning. He never bought any of it, not a word of it.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it's very interesting that I would say a turning point, if we could call it that, in my thinking came about Lenin and about communism and the whole sort of thing and the evolution of communism. Turning Point, I think, was, of course, it's very difficult, no doubt, to trace it to a single book. You know, it doesn't happen that way. But on the other hand, this was very important. And this is the François Furet book, The Passing of an Illusion, and the idea of communism in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that book is about probably, what, 10 years old by now?
Yeah,
or
it is, yeah.
Maybe a little bit older.
Uh-huh.
But around that, it's around 10 years old.
Yeah.
And that was a seminal book written by a man who was a former member of the Communist Party, a well-known French historian of the French Revolution primarily. And he wrote this about how the West, and particularly certain intellectuals, but large groups of them in all countries, not just the United States, but France, Britain, and Germany, and so on, how they had basically given Lenin and co. pretty much a free ride in saying, well, you know, to quote, of course, lots of people claim to have said this. I'm not sure exactly anymore who did. I used to think I knew who said it, but the basic attitude was summed up, shall I put it more cautiously, by the New York Times reporter Walter Duranty when he was confronted with, well, how can you say in the 1930s this is such a wonderful country when we have this famine going on in Ukraine and all these kinds of things? And Walter Duranty of the New York Times, who won a Pulitzer Prize, by the way, for this, said, well, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
Right, yeah, exactly. I didn't know that was Duranty.
Now, he's the one who, this is the one who usually, most recently, I've tracked this down, I've tried to track it down. It's possible that this is a Russian saying that he used, but certainly it's been traced to him and attributed to him most often. But the idea being, and the most important idea, the one you're talking about, namely that, you know, of course, you know, Lenin did horrible things, but, you know, on balance, the country really, you know, moved forward. It was, you know, on balance, it was a good thing. Would I want to live in Russia under these circumstances?
No.
Of course not.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the Russians, it's okay.
Uh-huh.
And we had the same attitude, by the way, in the 70s towards the Cultural Revolution in China. We thought, well, you know, would it be so bad for professors to have to go to work in the countryside for a while? That doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah.
What we didn't know is that, you know, tens of thousands of people were being murdered in the name of this.
Yeah, no.
And, of course, it was unthinkable that we'd actually want to go to live in China, but we thought, hey, this is a good thing for the Chinese. You know, it's sort of like development. This will help them develop, and it'll be a good thing.
Yeah, it's a very patronizing attitude, really.
It is, terribly. It's almost, I won't say it's racist, but it's certainly patronizing at the very least.
Yeah.
The idea, of course, now we now know, of course, and I'm reminded of a line in of the very famous novel by Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago, when one of the characters, Dr. Zhivago, looks at his female companion and says, how long is it that we have to pay for the sins of our fathers?
Yeah.
And she says, I think it's four generations. And he says...
That's funny.
He says that's 200 years, and we're still paying for Peter the Great.
Yeah. No.
So I don't know what if it's quite. I'm not making an equivalency here between Peter the Great and Lenin.
I see. Yeah. No, I see.
But I would say that but I don't think the Russians are going to get over the Soviets are going to get over the Russian Revolution and the experiment there for a long time.
Yeah. No, I think you're
at the present moment. Just to bring this right up to date, at the present moment. The Russian Federation, which is a reduced country from, you know, it doesn't have Ukraine anymore, it doesn't have Georgia anymore, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, and so on, or Belarus. But nevertheless, it's still the largest country in the world in 11 time zones. It's still a big country.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia today has a population now of 145 million. It is the projection in 50 years is that Russia will have a population of 100 million.
Yeah.
That is to say that it is involved in a major demographic, well, I suppose you could say we're on the edge of a major demographic catastrophe for that country.
Yeah, no, right.
And this is, to be very frank about it, this is still paying for the sins of the fathers.
Yeah.
And it is sad to say that so much of this, you know, for so long we were in denial, and in the West, and never mind in Russia, where the Lenin still resides in the mausoleum, you know, in Kremlin Square, we were in denial, and we did not want to see the evils that were perpetrated by communism.
Yeah.
Now, I, as a, sorry, as someone who went to the London School of Economics, which was in the 70s and 60s and 70s, notoriously very extremely left-wing, and, you know, lots of socialist and communist meetings all over the place, you know, I had to, I've basically like to think now I'm a moderate centrist and a non-committed and so on. But on the left, it was for a very, very long time taken as an axiom that this was fundamentally a good thing, and anybody who criticized it, anybody who said this is an, you know, this is like, if you say any conservative, let me put it another way, if there, any conservative said anything was wrong about the Soviet Union or China or something, they were automatically assumed to be incorrect and wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, just I mean, well, Richard Pipe is. Is damned, you know, very well, as much as I do. Richard Pipes is a fantastic historian and unbelievable strength. He's routinely defamed as being, you know, a right-wing nut and this, that, and the other thing.
I know. It is quite incredible. But what you said about the London School of Economics was true at Berkeley in the 1980s.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, you know, the thing about it was I kind of went to the Soviet Union for the first time as a sort of starry-eyed quasi-democratic socialist. But honestly, when I got there, I couldn't really believe what I was seeing. I really couldn't believe it, because it wasn't really what I was prepared for. And I came back with a very different opinion. But the people who were all around me, many of them, who had been there as well, didn't have that same opinion. And I always wondered about this. There's a good book, I'll plug another book, called The Fellow Travelers, by a fella named David Shute or Shouter. I don't know how you pronounce his name. It's C-A-U-T-E.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It's very readable and very good. How do you pronounce it?
Well, I've always called him Kaut.
Kaut. I don't know, but it's called The Fellow Travelers, and I would highly recommend
it.
Yeah, but to go back to Pipes for a second, I can remember reading for the first time Russia Under the Old Regime, which actually isn't about the communists. It's, it's about early modern sort of 18th and 19th century Russia, and thinking and just thinking, you know, this is a very sensible way to look at these things. But you're absolutely right. He is routinely pilloried as a kind of right-wing fanatic. But you can read, you know, in the 50s he wrote books, you know, The Formation of the Soviet Union, Which not based on any, there, you know, no secret archives, no, just published material, basically, as far as I could tell, and interviews with people who were there. And he says in all particulars what Lenin was up to. Rebuilding the empire, complete ruthlessness, total devotion to the cause, absolutely, you know, totally disregarded, you know, sort of just basic principles of humanity and human rights. Well, you know, just completely a fanatic. This is 1956.
He writes this. Well, you see, the thing is that what happens with people like this, with Richard Pipes and, is that anybody who, you know, a lot of people who damn him so much, they really haven't really read the book, but most importantly, they know the answer already, and they're not really interested.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
He did this new little book, I know you know this, The Unknown Lenin.
The Unknown Lenin,
The Unknown Lenin, Richard Pipes, and it's just all it is a collection of documents that he found that were deliberately kept from being published in Lenin's works. They're simply documents that Lenin wrote, published, sent here and there, or communications of various kinds. And these were deliberately not published because they would obviously detract from Lenin's image. And he, Mr. Pipes, then put these together and published them. And of course, you can read them for yourself. Forget his commentary, which is not crucial.
Right.
Just read the documents for yourself, and you'll see what he wants. You know, this is the man who's there saying things like, you know, execute, you know, hang him higher, and you know, find tough people, and on he goes. It's amazing.
I know.
It's quite right. There's a good biography, a recent biography by Robert Service about Lenin. I think it's called Lenin: A Life, in which I think it's the best biography I've read, which is very clear-eyed about the kind of person Lenin was. One of the anecdotes I just will recount very quickly: Lenin was a very tough guy, and he felt that social processes should work themselves out somehow. And Service describes him during a famine. I believe it was famine of 1890 or 1880. I don't remember which. In which Lenin would just step over dying people. And in explanation, instead of helping them, in explanation to this, he would say, well, you know, these things have to work themselves out. And I was just like, my word. That is a different person than I've ever met. It's quite interesting. I should tell you, we have taken up a huge amount of your time, but I could talk about these things endlessly, and I'm sure that our listeners could listen to them and listen to you talk so learnedly about all of them. But let me close with just this question. What are you working on now?
Okay. I promise I'll be a good boy. The first thing is that I would just draw attention to one quote in the Lenin, Stalin, Hitler book, and that is October 1917, when the revolution takes place, Russian time, Maxim Gorky, who's an intellectual at the time, says, can this experiment in socialism that Lenin wants, can this work? Of course it can't. But will it hurt to try? Well, of course it will. Gorky said, I promise you that the Russian people will pay for this experiment with lakes of blood.
Yeah.
And indeed, they have.
They did, yeah. No, there's no
they
question
have.
About it. Yeah, there's no question.
No, but, I go into all this in the book, and it's, there are some things about the book that we haven't gotten into, unfortunately, which is the whole evolution of the conflict between Hitler
and Stalin.
And Stalin in particular.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing now is what happened with this book here, which is a large book, but don't be deterred by that. It's got big print. What happened is that I got toward the end and I started to do a word count, and it was getting up to 280,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't the kind of number that publishers want to hear.
No.
They like nice round numbers, like 125,000.
Yeah, that's right.
They don't want a large books like that because it's difficult to sell and difficult to make any money on them from their point of view. So what I did is I began reducing or cutting it short as I approached the end of those regimes, the Nazi regime and the Stalinist regime.
Uh-huh.
And I carry the story to the end of Stalin, but what I'm doing now is that I'm focusing the new study on the period 1945 to 1956.
Uh-huh.
And there is no more Hitler, or not much Hitler in the book, but what I'm focusing on now is Stalin,
mm-hmm.
and particularly Stalin and Stalin's influence in Eastern Europe and throughout the creation of these new regimes there, and of course Germany as well, but also his broader influence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, the publishers are all very excited about it, so,
mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful.
Well,
it was incredibly exciting writing this last book, the Lenin book. I mean, every day was an excitement for me. I don't know if it's going to come across to the readers. Now, this one I'm doing now, I'm feeling the same way about it.
Great.
I can't believe that, I feel that there's so much there that we don't know, or we've been looking in other places and so on and so forth, but it's a very exciting period. And, we tend to just look at it in terms of the Cold War, and the Cold War tends to overshadow the social history of what went on in those times.
Yeah.
We're just concerned with sort of like watching a badminton match between the USSR and the USA, and we're forgetting about the people underneath, we just sort of overlook that.
Yeah.
Well, we really look forward to that book. Does it have a preliminary title yet, or an ETA or anything?
It doesn't. It's so, I gave it a title. Now it's just called something. I had a real fancy title for it, and I was applying for a grant at the university here, and the dean has to sign off on it, so the dean has to actually see your grant. And so I came in, and he's a busy man, and he came in to look at the grant to sign it, and it's just one page, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And one page summary, and he says, he looked at the title, and he looks me in the eye, and he says, this isn't one of the kind of proposals you have to read the whole thing to figure out what it's about.
That's very funny. I want I want that dean. Can we get that dean here, Dio?
So I said, okay, let's revise the title right now.
Yeah, right.
What do you think would, how about, social and political events in Europe, 1945, 1956, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it covers from the end of the war to the Hungarian Revolution.
Uh-huh.
But I think after the Hungarian Revolution, the the systems are sufficiently in place that I'm not saying no change takes place after that, but I think this is the most vital period where the change is really, you know, uproarious and fundamental. But I thought it was the funniest line coming from the dean.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a principle for all writers of grants in the future. Give him a description.
Right. That's exactly it. That's funny. Well, we really look forward to that. And I just want to thank you very much for giving your time to us today. It's been a fascinating conversation. The book is Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler, The Age of Social Catastrophe by Robert Gladley. And Robert, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for all your time and trouble. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. You too. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert Gladley about his book Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler, The Age of Social Catastrophe. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and we will talk to you next week.